industry.
It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. And with us today, joining us in the studio, is a friend of Fed Talk. We usually have this guest on our show in April for Police Week. So everybody's probably wondering, why is Craig Floyd joining us in October? But for our regular listeners, you will know that Craig Floyd is the chairman and the chief executive officer for the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. Many of you, if you're here in D.C., you've probably visited the memorial down at Judiciary Square. It really is quite beautiful. And we're very excited to be able to have Craig joining us mid-year for you and to help you celebrate the memorial's 20th anniversary. So, Craig, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Deborah. Love coming back.
I know. And usually, like I said, I was telling our staff, we only see you once a year on Fed Talk for Police Week, which is a really it's a special time for the fund and for the memorial. And there are a lot of really great events. And of course, there's the memorial service. But it's not Police Week. And what is it, Craig, that brings you back to Fed Talk in October?
Well, this is a very special milestone moment in the history of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. This is our 20th anniversary. We actually dedicated the National Memorial on October 15th of 1991. President and Mrs. Bush were there that day. I'll never forget, it was much like the weather we're experiencing today, probably mid-70s, sunny,
perfect,
not a cloud
DC
in the
weather.
Sky. Of course, they'd been predicting storms and rain the whole day or night before, so I was a little concerned. I felt some anxiety as I woke up that morning, but it was just gorgeous. About 2 hours after we cleared the site and had finished our ceremonies, the weather broke. It stormed for the next 3-4 days in a row, I believe. So we were spared that, and we were very fortunate. I'd like to thank God was looking down on us.
I was about to say, did you felt like divine intervention there?
I really did. I mean, it was unbelievable, the timing on it all. But it worked out beautifully. And here we are 20 years later. Hard to believe. I'll give you some perspective. When we dedicated the memorial, we had 12,521 names on the memorial walls. Mm-hmm. Today we have over 19,000. So we've added, unfortunately, too many new names to the memorial.
Yeah. For any of our listeners who've been down there, there's something, it's at the heart of Judiciary Square and in a park, and these gorgeous lions, right? They sort of mark the entrance to the memorial, and it's just a wall of names. And for every law enforcement officer in our country that's killed in the line of duty, the memorial posts their name.
You know, interestingly, on the lions, we had originally thought we would put a grouping of law enforcement figures, actual representations of law enforcement officers in a group statuary, similar to what you see down at the Vietnam Veterans
Right.
Memorial. And that was our model. When we proposed that to the Commission of Fine Arts and the National Capital Planning Commission, the agencies that have to review these things, They were very discouraging about the idea. They had been through the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and approval of that statue, and they were concerned that if we tried to somehow represent law enforcement in 3 or 4 or 5 figures even, How would you capture all of it? There's so many different branches of law enforcement, federal, state, and local.
Right.
Everyone has their own uniform, their own badge, ethnicity, female, male, black, white, Hispanic, Asian. How do you do that? And the answer was we couldn't appropriately. So come up with a symbolic statue that would represent all of law enforcement. And our sculptor, Ray Caskey, a renowned sculptor.
They're gorgeous, those statues.
They really are.
They're very powerful.
And they're representational of the strength, the courage, the valor that are all hallmarks of the law enforcement professional. So it works out beautifully. And then you have an adult lion overseeing a group of cubs who represent, obviously, the innocent citizens of this nation in a guardian-like role. So it's just fantastic. It worked beautifully, and everybody gets it when they see it.
Yeah. I've tried to get down to the memorial during police week for your memorial ceremony, the candlelight ceremony. And I've tried to make it down there several times, and, you know, it's always something that gets in the way. Maybe this year I'll really do it. But I visited the park by happenstance several times when just getting off at Judiciary Square, like middle of a business day. And I was like, oh, that's right. And I occasionally go and visit it. And, you know, I don't think it matters if you're not there. I'm sure I've heard from my friends at FLIOA that the candlelight vigil is really, really something and very powerful. But I have to say that just visiting it during an average regular day, especially a pretty day like today, there's something very touching and serene about it. It's very much there are similar kinds of feelings that I get when I go to the Vietnam Memorial, different but similar. And I think they've done such a good job. It's such a really well done memorial in a park of sort of central location in D.C. Where people would just pass through happenstance on foot traffic and get caught up in something. There's a quiet peace. There's a quiet peacefulness there.
And we have to thank Davis Buckley, the architect of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. He's a D.C.-based architect that we were fortunate to have met early in this process. In fact, Jan Scruggs, who built the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, introduced me to Davis. Jan was tremendously helpful in so many ways, guiding me through this very difficult process of building a national monument. He had done it very successfully, and so he took me over to Davis, and Davis designed this fabulous park-like setting. It just fit beautifully within the Judiciary Square surroundings. And you feel like it's been there forever.
You do. You feel like it was all thought, the whole surrounding circumstance, you feel it was all planned together at the same time. It's very well done. But here we are 20 years later. Tell me what the impetus was. How did that get started? Because the rest of our show we're going to talk about, in the second half of our show, we're going to talk about what's going on across the street from the memorial. But there was an impetus for this memorial, and I know it was a big effort.
Well, when I got out of college, I went to George Washington University here in D.C., and I had done an internship on Capitol Hill, and it gave me the bug. I had to get a job on Capitol Hill for a congressman or senator, and I managed, in great fortune in my life, I managed to be hooked up with Mario Biaggi, congressman from New York City, represented parts of the Bronx and Queens and part of Yonkers. And Congressman Biaggi, before he came to Congress, was a 23-year veteran of the New York City Police Department. He had been wounded 10 times in the line of duty. He was the most decorated police officer in New York City history when he retired. And then he spent 20 years in Congress, and he was the go-to guy on law enforcement issues. And a group of law enforcement officers came into his office one day when I was working for him, and they said, "Congressman, I know there was this bill that you had introduced earlier, back in the 70s, actually. We'd like you to revive it. It was to build a National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial." And this was in 1981. We introduced the legislation, and in 1984, it became law. And that's how the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial got started. Of course, that meant we had a lot of work left to do.
You have the land.
That was maybe the easy part.
Right.
Yeah, we spent 7 years raising the money, picking the site, designing the memorial, and finally on October 15, 1991, the job was completed. And a lot of people helped along the way. We had corporate support. DuPont was our largest corporate contributor. Motorola was another major contributor, Ford Motor Company. And over a million Americans contributed money to build that memorial. We had a huge direct mail campaign, very successful. And in the end, I'd like to think that that memorial was truly a gift of appreciation from the American people to the men and women who serve and sacrifice in law enforcement.
And did you ever think, isn't that interesting, because you spent your entire career there after working for a member of Congress. Did you ever think you'd catch the bug? Because you if people who know you, they know you've caught the bug.
I would agree with that, Deborah. That's a good assessment, because early on, this was just one of many projects that were put on my plate. You know, the congressman gave me this responsibility. We got the legislation enacted into law, and then it was like, now what? And so he assigned me to get it done. And I assumed when the memorial was completed, that would be the end. But after some real good thinking,
20 years later,
we decided that was the beginning, not the end. And I couldn't be happier doing what I do.
Yeah. And of course, I think your constituents, you know, the men and women in law enforcement throughout our country, are very thankful that you stuck with it, because as our listeners will learn in the next part of our show, you've really taken these issues and these interests to the very next level. And it's all very exciting, I think, particularly for people here in the district who live here and are going to be able to enjoy the museum. We're going to talk about the museum and your efforts to build it, but we do need to take our first break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hello, my federal friends. It's the Geico Gecko, and I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news. Geico now offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right. Geico, the government employees insurance company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about Geico's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. With me in the studio this morning is Craig Floyd. He's the chairman and CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. And if you're just joining us and missed the first part of our show, Craig's here to talk with us about the memorial's 20th anniversary. And of course, for those people in law enforcement, you must know that the fund is now building a museum. But 20 years later, Craig, here we are 20 years later, it's not just the memorial that was built. There's, over the past two decades, the fund has had some additional accomplishments. The memorial, obviously, is 20 years old. And in those 20 years, you've done some other things other than just run, you know, the park and begin the efforts for the museum.
No, we're very proud of our record of achievement. Obviously, the memorial is the centerpiece of everything that we do. It's our crown jewel, I like to say.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Thank you. And I hope everybody visits. I don't know if we've mentioned the address, but it's the 400 block of E Street, Northwest Washington. You get off on the Red Line. There's a subway stop right beneath our memorial. It's called Judiciary Square. And there's appropriate signage to follow that directs you to the exit that'll get you right underneath the memorial grounds. That was in 1991. 1993, we actually opened a visitor center just a couple blocks away from the memorial, and that allowed our visitors to have a little more of a meaningful experience. They learned about some of the history behind the memorial and the officers that we honor there. 1994, one of my favorite achievements in our history. That was when we passed a law, requested a law to be passed by Congress. Representative John Porter from Illinois was actually the author of this law. It says that the flags of the United States should be lowered to half staff on May 15th, which is Peace Officers Memorial Day every year. And I think we all know that the only other day on the calendar when that honor is given is Memorial mm-hmm. Day to honor the fallen military mm-hmm. personnel who have died in war. And so we're very pleased that Congress would view law enforcement in much the same way. 1996, Congress passed another law that authorized up to $500,000 silver dollars that would commemorate the service and sacrifice of law enforcement officers and their families. We sold 140,000 of those coins, and we raised over $1.4 million to maintain the memorial. It was put into a maintenance endowment fund. And then, of course, in 2000, we had a law enacted that authorized us to take the next major step in mm-hmm. our progression, and that was to build a National Law Enforcement Museum right across the street from the memorial in Judiciary Square that would really be the perfect complement to the monument yeah. itself.
It should be really, really impressive when it's completed. You also host Police Week every – is it April or May?
May, it's always the week that starts on a Sunday, ends on a Saturday, and includes May 15th, which is, in fact, Peace Officers Memorial Day. And that was a law enacted by Congress back in 1962. President Kennedy actually signed that law, and it said that that week would be each year considered to be National Police Week. And that would be the week we honor the men and women who serve us so well in law enforcement.
Yeah, and as I told our listeners at the very beginning of the show, we always bring you back either the week before, the week of Police Week, get the word out, let people know what all of the activities going on during Police Week. The memorial has, very much like the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, it has the name of every police officer killed in the line of duty, state, local, and feds. Most of our listeners are feds. And I think the statistic is there's about 1,100 names of federal law enforcement officers on the wall. But I know that you maintain a database of names. Is that accessible to the public?
Absolutely. In fact, that was one of our big decisions back in 1988, roughly, when we were designing this memorial. We said, you know, should it have the names of the officers who've been killed in the line of duty? Because, of course, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial was really the model at that time mm-hmm. for what you did with memorials and monuments. And they, of course, listed all 58,000 plus names of the people who died in Vietnam. So we said, you know, we have to do that for law enforcement. The problem was, we had no central clearinghouse, no database.
How'd you get all the? How'd you collect all those names?
Well, it was not easy. I mean, we literally did mailing after mailing to departments nationwide. We even had the Attorney General of the United States sign a letter for us to those departments.
Then, of course, for our listeners, they have to remember 20 years ago, like, nobody communicated by email. It didn't exist. So you actually had to send a letter.
That's right. It was snail mail or nothing.
It was very slow.
Or call everyone.
And you couldn't look everybody up on the internet. You couldn't be like, put in a Google search and be, let me have every police department in Minnesota.
Wouldn't that have been a lot easier? We actually did hire at one time a telemarketing firm, not to raise money, but to call every agency that we had never heard from in these letters that we would send them. And they would literally call every one of the 18,000 or so law enforcement agencies in America and say, do you have any records of officers from your department who've been killed in the line of duty? And eventually, we created this wonderful database that had never been done before. And now, to this day, we have 19,298 files on every officer whose name is inscribed on our memorial walls.
You know, what just occurred to me is I've done this show with you. Not this past year, but I've done the Police Week show with you, and it never occurred to me how you got the names.
It's
like I never thought about, well, how'd they get them? Because they're there on the wall now, so that just, you know, you just sort of process. It's hard to process that there are 19,000 names. But when I think about 20 years ago, because I was working. I was not a child. I know what it was like 20 years ago. The effort that it must have taken. Now, of course, those were like, you know, you were collecting then, you know, trying to collect names of current. How did you, because when I remember reading off your website, isn't the first, the oldest name on your memorial, isn't it from 1791 or something?
That's correct. Sheriff.
Right. How did you get the historical data?
It hasn't been easy, but because we've become more well-known over the years, we get a lot of help, okay? Just a couple quick stories that you bring to mind. There was this guy, Ronald Van Ralty. I'll never forget Ron. He was a good old guy, and he was taking it on his own to go around the country and visit cemeteries and meet with law enforcement agency heads and so forth. And he was actually compiling this record of officers killed in the line of duty. Now, the problem is Ron was a one-man show. He did not have the resources that we have at the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. So I said to Ron, I said, to help you and to help us both, why don't we merge our partnership here?
Did he feel taken over?
And in a way he did. He said, you know, Craig, a few of the groups that are on your board, I don't really feel like they've been cooperating with me. So, you know, I think I'm just going to continue to do my own thing.
I like
you
a one-man
guys,
show.
Good luck to you guys, you know?
Right.
And so
we'll see who gets
Ron,
to the finish line first.
Ron recently passed, and I always felt bad that he never had that fulfillment. He wanted to build a memorial. He wanted to build a museum for law enforcement. And we're doing it, and I wish he had joined us early on when we gave him that opportunity, because I think it would have really been fulfilling for him. But I'll never forget Ron. So he told me, I think there's 30,000 officers out there. That's his estimate when we started the process. And so we went about it, and lo and behold, when we dedicated the memorial, there were about 12,500. Now, what's happened since, Deborah, is we found a lot of the older deaths that had not been uncovered when we dedicated the memorial. Because despite our best efforts to get information from the departments, they didn't know a lot about the older deaths in, from their department.
Right, I could expect that. They might not. They might have some current information or information that may have dated back a decade or two, but that doesn't take you back 100 years.
Right. And that was the challenging part. And the FBI actually had records dating back to about 1961. That's how far back they went. And at one point we said, well, maybe we should just put the names that we know from the FBI. And then somebody said, well, what about the officer who died like on December 31st of 1960? You know, we're not going to put them on. And so obviously it became very easy to make that decision that we've got to try to find every officer who's ever died in the line of duty. Cornelius Hogeboom is the first officer ever to die in the line of duty. He was an upstate New York sheriff from Columbia County. And he was shot and killed in 1791. Now, the interesting thing about his story is we didn't know anything about Cornelius Hogeboom until this past year. We were doing some research. We have a full-time research staff, and we stumbled upon his case through some old files and newspaper records and such. And lo and behold, Cornelius Hogeboom is now recognized as the first officer ever to die in the history of the United States. Before him, we thought it was a guy named Isaac Smith, who was a deputy sheriff from New York City. He died in 1792.
Oh, by a year.
We learned about him 10 years ago, and he had that dubious distinction for the last decade. And before him, when we dedicated the memorial, we actually thought it was a federal agent, a U.S. Marshal named Robert Forsyth, who died, I'll never forget, I think it was January 11th, 1794. And Robert Forsyth's name was on the memorial when we dedicated it, and we had no idea that there might have been any officers who died before him.
1794, 1792, 1791.
Yeah.
It's getting very interesting. And, of course, that sort of, you know, the obvious then is that this must be an evolving process. So it's like it's not necessarily that the number of names grow going forward. The number of names grow as your staff uncovers historical information that otherwise wasn't known.
Very much so. In fact, this past year, to give you an example, we added 316 names to the memorial. 152 of those officers died last year, But the rest of the officers that we added actually died earlier in our history, including Cornelius Hogeboom in 1791. So, we're going to continue to find these older deaths. I hope at some point, you know, the numbers slow down because that'll mean, you know, we've exhausted all the research efforts and sources. But the fact of the matter is, in Texas, for example, there's a corps of probably about a dozen former law enforcement officers, retired, who have taken it on their own to find all the older Texas deaths. And they send us thick files that are in such great order. Every page is documented beautifully. And then we send that file off to the agency head that, mm-hmm. that was involved with that officer. And we ask them to sign off on it and verify that this information is, in fact, correct. And usually we're finding that the departments had no idea that that officer had died back in the 1800s, and that we're doing them a favor by presenting them with that information. So they sign it, they send it back to us, and then the following May, we add those names to the memorial.
Yeah, it's the amount of appreciation that people must feel who dedicate their lives and feel sort of the kinship with historical figures to sort of take their time and energy to uncover, you know, past information about past people and get it out to the memorial. It makes me smile. It's very nice that people would put that kind of effort. They're truly forgotten, and someone hundreds of years later is trying to uncover them and remember them. It's very nice.
I remember when we had a 200th anniversary ceremony for Robert Forsyth at the National Memorial, and I had the director of the Marshal Service at the time. And he spoke very briefly, but I'll never forget the words. He said, "Today we're reminded that whether an officer died 200 years ago or a year ago, they're always going to be remembered here at the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial."
And really, and so much of that speaks to the efforts of not just you and your staff, but the citizens out there who the representation your memorial has to them, that they put their own personal effort into finding out who these people are and making sure they're remembered. That's very sweet. It's God's work. And of course, I do want to get to the museum, which is going to be for, you know, when you think about it, it's like kids' work, because what a great place, having done the show before on what the museum's going to be like. And we are going to talk with Craig Floyd about the development of the museum and where it stands today, but we need to take our mid-show break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey, it's the Geico Gecko. Now, as a federal employee, you're probably one for a smart presentation, so I've put together some charts and graphs here. There you go. That will help illustrate the money you could save by switching to Geico. First thing you'll notice is that Geico now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. Now this is big news, but that shouldn't come as any surprise from a car insurance company that has been serving government employees since 1936. And as you can see on this graph here, it's probably why we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. Yeah, no, I do actually realise you can't see these, but trust me, they're rather impressive. Especially the 97% customer satisfaction rate. And when you consider it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more, well, all you GS7 employees or above should just contact Geico. Tell him, Mike.
Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey, and the Gecko said it best. Most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above, could get a discount on their car insurance. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune into Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and joining me today in the studio is Craig Floyd. He's the chairman and chief executive officer for the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. We spent the first part of our show talking about the actual memorial and its history and where it is. And for our listeners, certainly you can go onto their website. If you just type in National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, I'm sure in any search engine, You'll be able to find their website and see actual pictures of the memorial. But now, Craig, it's time to talk about the big ticket item that must take up so much of your time, which is the museum. You got Congress to authorize the building of Museum and the Land in 2000, which was 11 years ago, and it took 10 years to get groundbreaking.
It was a determined effort.
10 years.
Yes, October 14th of last year, almost 1 year to the day, we broke ground on the museum. It's a lot tougher to build a national museum.
I found out that it is a memorial,
and that memorial was plenty tough. Thank you. But it's such a gratifying feeling to know that very soon we're going to have a museum where people can go right across the street from our national memorial and learn the stories behind the 19,298 names on the memorial walls, for example. But more than that, this museum will tell the complete story of law enforcement's history, the many contributions they've made throughout the history of our nation. I mean, we could not have the liberties and freedoms that we enjoy today if it weren't for these men and women in law enforcement that protect us and preserve our freedoms and liberties. And really, we often say, and I think there's a lot of truth to it, they are that thin blue line that stands between chaos and law and order. And you take law enforcement out of the equation, and this place would be a far different country than we lived in, and it wouldn't be nearly as a pleasant an experience.
Mm-hmm. And a police force that people have confidence in. I mean, you know, that's the other thing that I think always gets lost in the dialogue is, you know, the dialogue in our country is always about it's protecting us from harm, from people who would want, you know, people who would want to do harm to each other. But it's also a police force that people have confidence in that are going to correctly enforce the law, because, you know, you just watch the news over the past year and you see police forces that become tools of a tyrannical government. And we don't know that in our country. We haven't seen that. And so we're very fortunate to be able to have state and local and federal police forces that people have confidence in.
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, amazing.
I mean, people call 911. They want them to come.
They do. And they do respond. This morning, coincidentally, I had a conversation on the phone with one of our corporate sponsors, a former FBI agent, actually. He's now with Target. And Brad said to me, he said, Craig, I just got back from a cruise in the Mediterranean, went to a number of countries over there. He said the amazing thing is that they do not treat law enforcement with anywhere close to the same level of respect and trust that they do here in the United States. I mean, echoing your sentiments exactly. And I think
many countries, they're viewed as a tool, a tyrannical tool of a government that's oppressing its people. And they're viewed with suspicion and stay away. In our country, you know, if someone's in trouble, they're like, call 911, and you want them to come.
And it's an amazing evolution that we've seen in law enforcement in this country from the earliest colonial days, where it was called the hue and cry, where volunteer citizens would walk the streets at night. And if they saw any trouble, usually it was a fire that they were looking for, they would cry out. And people would come running with buckets of water, or they'd beat up the criminal that was trying to cause harm, whatever the case might be. But that was a volunteer form of law enforcement in this country. Back in the early 1600s in Boston, that's the first known system of law enforcement that we've been able to identify. It was called the Night Watch, and it was volunteerism. And then about 30 years or so later, Boston also became the first to professionalize law enforcement. They actually paid people to perform that function and serve that role in our society. And from there, it evolved to the point where today we have about 800,000 sworn federal, state, and local law enforcement professionals. They are far more professional and highly educated, better trained than ever before, than look back 20, 30, 40 years ago. So this is a different breed of law enforcement professional today than we had, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And these are the best trained, best prepared men and women for the job. And we give them the best possible equipment. And as a result, and this is amazing to me, Deborah, We have about three times the number of officers serving today than we did, say, back around 1970, okay? But we actually have fewer officers being killed in the line of duty today than we did back in the 70s. Back in the 1970s, the deadliest decade in law enforcement history, we lost 228 officers on average every year. Over the past decade, we've lost about 164 each year.
How do we account for that?
Better equipment, better training, more manpower, backing each other up, serving more as a deterrent to crime. I mean, think about it. Violent crime in this country, we've been told over the last 20 years, is at its record low levels since we started tracking it.
Right.
And how do you explain that? I mean, we know there's a lot of bad people out there willing to do harm, but thankfully we have this well-trained, well-equipped, and so many more law enforcement officers serving that they're able to keep the violent crime in this nation down, putting themselves at great risk. 164 officers killed a year. That means over the last decade, we've lost about 1,640 officers in the line of duty. And that's why it's safer in America today, because those men and women are willing to go out and put their lives at risk for our safety and our protection. Sometimes it costs them their lives, but we saw it on 9/11, 10th anniversary we just passed. We saw an extreme example of that, where these men and women were doing amazing things on our television screens. And all of a sudden, the American people realized, wow, our officers are pretty incredible. And what they didn't realize is that that level of service and sacrifice is occurring in communities all over this country. And it has been for hundreds of years.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's, you know, when I drive at night, when I drive on the highway and you see the state troopers pulled over someone for some sort of violation. And, you know, the lights on the side of the road, and they tip their car out, you know, to keep, you know, the cars from. And when you look at local news, how many times a year you hear about a police officer on the side of the road who's pulled someone over at night who got hit by a passing driver? It's like I always think about that. And I'm always very careful when I pass that myself, because it's dark and, you know, they and the lights are distracting, I think, for people who are passing by, but it's just pulling someone over for a traffic stop, you know, speeding on the highway. You always hear about at least one a year, an officer who got killed by a passerby who just didn't see him or her, the officer. And that's just picking up a car that's speeding.
That's actually, the number is even higher. It's about 16 per year are struck and killed on the side of roadways outside of their vehicle, oftentimes at accident
scenes,
construction sites, seemingly benign situations. Yeah. We, the driving public, would assume that officer's just kind of taking a break. You know, there's no real heavy-duty work going on. But in fact, they are at great risk in those situations. And they're there with those flashing lights, as you say. What a lot of people have found in these tests that they've done is that a drowsy or drunken driver is sometimes pulled toward those flashing lights.
They're distracting.
Like a magnet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like the car is sitting there on the side of the road, and then this drunk driver or this drowsy driver just all of a sudden it drives their vehicle into that vehicle.
You know, you feel like the insects, you know, driven to a light bulb. But I when I say they're distracting, the lights are distracting from keeping your eyes driving down the road, a dark road at night. The lights are distracting. And I always think about that when I pass it, like, be careful, it's dangerous. It's a dangerous job what they do, pulling people over. And I knew that statistic. I think I knew it from the guys at FLIOA. I forgot the actual number, but it's surprising.
It's very high, and thankfully, there's a law of the land now that's been put into effect over the last few years. It's called Move Over and Slow Down. And 49 states in this nation have this law now. So what it means is, if you see an emergency vehicle, a police vehicle, say, on the side of a roadway, and you have the opportunity, you are required by law to
change
move
lanes.
Over a lane.
Yeah.
Obviously, do it safely if you have that option, and slow down regardless. All right. So if you can't move over a lane, at least you're required to slow down to a much more reasonable rate of speed. So you give that officer an added margin of safety. Unfortunately, a survey that was recently done found that 71% of Americans had no knowledge of that law. So today, we're doing a good service by
I know, I'm part of the 71. I just sort of knew it intuitively, and also because I know it from my clients and from people like you, I know that that's, and then you watch the news and it connects in your mind that that's a very dangerous part of law enforcement is the average traffic stop or working for police officers who work at the construction site, that they actually, that's like a likely place where they get killed. And so I sort of tune in when I personally am driving down the road. I always tune in because I know that information. And you're right, that is a good stat to get out. And maybe our newsletter fit agent can figure out a way to get that out in a, you know, to a greater audience. But we diverged from the museum. You had groundbreaking a year ago. Today, Craig, you're not going to see much, right?
There's actually a lot of construction work going on,
but you won't
it's
see,
not
like, building.
Real sexy.
Right.
It's a lot of utility relocation work, moving steam vaults, hooking up electrical lines, water lines. All of this is necessary before we get to the major excavation and what we call core and shell work, which is the big dig. This will be mainly an underground museum, Deborah. So if you go down to Judiciary Square, you're standing at the memorial. You see on one side, the F Street side, is the National Building Museum, this beautiful old red brick building.
It is beautiful, yeah.
And then on the opposite end of the memorial site, across E Street, will be the site for the National Law Enforcement Museum. And it will be built right in front of what is now the D.C. Court of Appeals. Beautiful old historic building. It was actually the original City Hall here in Washington, D.C. So it's a major landmark for the nation's capital. And our museum will be built right in front of the D.C. Court of Appeals in what is now the plaza in front of the Court of Appeals.
So I've walked that plaza many times.
It's a beautiful place. And Judiciary Square looks great today. Not as great with the construction work going on, but once we build this museum and clear away the construction work and get rid of the cars that tend to be parked on E Street up until our construction started, that place is going to be one of the great jewels of Washington, D.C., a place where people need to go just to see it, but then hopefully experience this memorial that's there and has been for 20 years and experience this National Law Enforcement Museum. Most of it underground. We'll have two glass entrance pavilions above ground, and then people will descend down into the major spaces of the museum where we'll have these wonderful experiences for people. This is an experiential museum. It's going to be interactive, and a lot of artifacts populating the museum. People are going to love it. We have the RoboCop costume from the movie,
yeah,
Jack Bauer's sweatshirt, Al Capone's bulletproof vest.
That'll be fun.
We have writs from the 1700s. We have everything you can imagine, all the weaponry, all the handcuffs and so forth. But it's going to be an experience, but we're going to put people in the shoes of an officer, learn what it's like to go through some of the training that officers experience, the shoot, don't shoot judgmental simulator. We'll have a forensic science lab where you get clues from real crimes, and then you learn how fingerprinting and DNA and blood spatter is used to solve those crimes. We'll have a reel-to-reel area, R-E-E-L to R-E-A-L, where we're going to compare and contrast Hollywood's version of law enforcement, show a lot of the clips from the old shows and movies, and then have real officers critiquing it. Dragnet will be part of it. Jack Webb's wife actually gave us a lot of his memorabilia, so we now have a Jack Webb collection as part of our overall collection.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Exactly. And we have J. Edgar Hoover's collection. We acquired that last July. The J. Edgar Hoover Foundation gave it to us. They wanted a way to preserve the legacy of Hoover. So we have all of his speeches, his desk, his telephone, his photographs throughout his life. We have everything that's J. Edgar Hoover, and we'll make them available to the public to come in and research this great figure from American law enforcement history and learn who Hoover is. By the way, Clint Eastwood, our honorary chairman of the museum, is actually producing a movie about J. Edgar Hoover, and it comes out this fall.
I know, and I read something in the paper. It was like it wasn't controversial, but we'll talk about that after our last break. We do need to take the final break of our show. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
It's the Geico Gecko with a little hello to all you federal employees. Now, in government, there are people on all points of the political spectrum. But there is one thing that everyone agrees on. Saving money is good. Which brings me to the big news. GEICO now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. It don't matter if you're a Democrat or an aristocrat, left wing, right wing or a chicken wing. If you're a federal employee GS7 or above, you could be saving a lot of money on your car insurance by switching to GEICO. So no matter if you're blue or red or in my case green, If you're a federal employee, GS 7 or above, contact GEICO and see how much you could save. Isn't that right, Mike?
Exactly right, my little green friend. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. And like the Gecko said, discounts are available for most federal employees, GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and with me today in the studio is Craig Floyd. He's the chairman and chief executive officer for the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. And Craig, right before the break, we were talking about the museum, which, you know, sounds like it's just going to be one of those must-go-to destinations in Washington. I always tell friends and family who are visiting, I've lived in the district for, I don't know, a long time now, over 25 years. And when people come who've never been to D.C. before, they're like, which museum should I go to? What do I have to see? And I always say there's Americana. There's pieces of Americana that no matter who you are, what generation, what walk of life you come from, there are things you absolutely must see, you know, obviously the memorials. And then there's I always like to send people to see Archie Bunker's chair, right? And now you can see Julia Child's kitchen, and you can see Dorothy's ruby red slippers. And there are these pieces of Americana all over the mall. And for people who want to dig deeper into art and sciences, they have that too. But it sounds like you've, you know, picked this museum is going to have a plethora of Americana in there that particularly, you know, it's ageless, because I think, kids today, their parents, their grandparents, there's something about what you're collecting. Like, everybody knows who J. Edgar Hoover is. It just depends upon your age, you know, your generation, your walk of life, what you think you know about him. But everybody sort of views him to be an American icon. It sounds like it's just going to be one big piece of Americana.
Well, when you think about it, I mean, look on the TV guide, and what are the shows that you see every night on television? It's cop shows or reality shows, but most of the non-reality shows are cop shows. And so people are intrigued by law enforcement without question. I mean, we have a very successful museum in Washington. It's called the International Spy Museum, right? Now, I think the name alone attracts people, and they've done a great job marketing their product, and we've met with their leadership. They've been very helpful to us. But I look at that and I say, well, geez, if people are willing to go in droves to a spy museum where they know very little about the history of spies, right, they're definitely going to want to come to our law enforcement museum, because that's equally intriguing, and everybody has a connection with law enforcement that they don't, say, with spies or some of these other historical museums. If you ask any American today, probably, they're going to tell you, you know, good example. I was playing golf the other day. Three people in my foursome, I didn't know them particularly well. But it turns out one of them was a supporter of ours, gave money through our direct mail campaign. Another was a retired officer, all right? And the third was a survivor. His grandfather had been killed in the line of duty, and he had visited our memorial many, many times, never knew me. I didn't know him that well. And it turns out that those three people, just a random sample citizenry.
And no one you knew.
And they all had a connection to law enforcement and to our memorial.
Yeah.
So I think that tells you that this thing is going to be a huge hit, and I can't wait for it to open.
What's your expected, I know you've barely broken ground, so what's your expected completion date?
Well, we're looking at late 2013, early 2014. So this is moving along at a pretty good clip. We still have some fundraising to finish up. We have probably about another $15 million to raise in new cash and pledges before all is said and done. But we've raised over $45 million. We're well underway now with the construction process.
$45 million you've raised?
$45 million, all privately donated.
That's what I wanted our listeners to know, because I knew that. It's all private funds.
Congress said in the law, they said no taxpayer dollars will be used to build this museum. So it's all on us, and we've relied heavily on corporate America. We have $10 million plus contributors, all the big names. Our largest are DuPont and Motorola Solutions. Each of them gave $3 million. Target gave $1.5 million. Verizon gave $1.5 million. just to name a couple of the big donors. But law enforcement has actually raised more money than corporate America. They've donated almost $15 million to build this museum, showing how important this museum is to the law enforcement professionals that serve us. So that's I'm very proud of that fact.
And anybody can donate, right?
We encourage citizens to make a donation.
And they can donate on your website, because I've been there.
And they can go to www.lawmemorial.org, lawmemorial.org, no punctuation there, and they'll see a donate button and they can learn how to support us. There's also volunteer opportunities and a great way to learn more about the memorial and about this museum that we're building.
So 45 in the bank, 45 million in the bank, you have 15 million more to raise. In order to get to completion. And I know there's a gala next week to celebrate not only the 20th anniversary of the memorial, but also to raise money for the museum.
That's correct. And this is a 20th anniversary gala. So we're certainly going to have a celebratory theme of
I'm
the
going.
Evening. And I can't wait to
excited.
See Deborah all dressed up.
I know, I'm very excited.
This is going to be a wonderful event. But it's worthy of celebration. I mean, a lot of the people that were there from the beginning, our architect, our sculptor, our people that built the memorial, the construction team, Clark Construction built it. They'll all be there along with law enforcement leaders from all over the country. A lot of the survivors of officers whose names are inscribed on the memorial walls will be there. So this is just going to be a time to say, 20 years ago, this country didn't have any special recognition for our law enforcement professionals. That was the day, October 15, 1991, when all that changed, because we dedicated a national monument to honor this very special group of people that serve and sacrifice for our safety. And they deserve to be recognized. We take them for granted far too often. That memorial helped to change the way we mm-hmm. think about law enforcement in
it
this country.
It had to help in your fundraising for the museum, because it's so beautiful, that memorial.
Exactly. And we love to show people what we've done yeah. with the memorial. This is an example yeah. of what we want to do with this museum. It's going to be first class. World-class museum, obviously, and it'll tell a story that needs to be told and has never been told before.
And you were fortunate enough to have Clint Eastwood become your honorary chairman?
Yes, Clint Eastwood.
Come on.
Dirty
is
Harry.
Is he going to be at the gala?
He will not be there in person. I hate to tell you that, Deborah. I'm sorry to break it to you. But but you will hear a message delivered by Clint
it's
Eastwood.
It's not
that
the real
night.
Thing, is it?
It's not. But I assure you he will be in Washington sometime soon, and we'll hopefully get you a chance to visit with Clint.
How did you guys get him to be your honorary chairman? That's really remarkable. He's iconic in that sort of genre.
He really is. He is an American icon, and we couldn't be prouder to have him. We have a volunteer leader out in California in Hollywood named Shannon Murphy, who actually approached him on our behalf. Turns out he was making a movie about J. Edgar Hoover.
Right.
And it just so happens that we had just acquired the J. Edgar Hoover collection. So one of the first things he did when he learned about that is sent part of his team out to visit our collection and see what we had to help them with the movie. And we sent him copies of his speeches, photographs, and I think he found that to be very helpful. And he has a great appreciation for law enforcement.
Yeah.
I've seen him interact with law enforcement officers. He embraces them. He thanks them genuinely from his heart. And this cause is very important to him, and mm-hmm. he is going to help us in many, many ways. He's assured us of that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big name, and you can only hope with the big name. I mean, the serendipity of the timing of his movie and, your ability to then take possession of the J. Edgar Hoover collection, that really worked out for everybody. And hopefully, with his cachet, you'll be able to meet that 15. He'll somehow help you, hopefully, get that $15 million in the bank so you can complete the memorial.
And he is committed to helping us with the fundraising. He's already done some public service announcements for us. He's working with us to put on some private events maybe related to the movie that might help raise money and awareness. So we're off and running. The last event, I know we're coming to the close here, but I wanted people to be aware of another fundraising event we're doing. It's called the Ride and Run to Remember. And this is the first time we've really combined a road race, which we've done for the last 3 years, a 5K road race, with up to a 62-mile bike ride, a metric century bike ride, a half-century bike ride, 31 miles for the...
And when is that?
That's going to be next Sunday, October 16th, starting at National Harbor for the bikers, starting at the memorial for the road race. And they can go to rideandruntoremember.org.
Okay, it's been a great show. Craig Floyd of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, thank you for joining us.
WFED Washington.